all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. We are recording today from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. Legal Help for Veterans is a veterans disability law firm, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800. Our guest today on Veterans Radio is Nancy Sherman. Professor Sherman is, and this may be the first professor of philosophy we've ever spoken to on Veterans Radio, so we're kind of interested to explore with Professor Sherman her new book called After War, Healing the Moral Wounds of Our Soldiers. Professor Sherman, say hello to the Veterans Radio listening audience.
Very nice to be with you. Thanks so much, Jim, for having me.
Oh, we're glad to have you on the program. Professor Sherman is a distinguished professor of philosophy at Georgetown University. She holds a PhD from Harvard University in philosophy. She has been involved with military issues for a long time. Back in 1999, she served as the inaugural holder of the Distinguished Chair in Ethics at the United States Naval Academy. She's written over 50 published articles in the general area of ethics, history of moral philosophy, ancient philosophy, and military ethics. She also served on a team in October of 2005 at the invitation of the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs to visit Guantanamo Bay Detention Center to observe and advise on medical and psychological conditions of detainees and matters of medical ethics. So she comes to this area of ethics and military affairs with a long pedigree and a very interesting background. Professor Sherman, tell us a little bit about your book, After War, Healing the Moral Wounds of Our Soldiers.
Well, the book is really a way of thinking about some of the students that came home from war and found their way into my classes. That's in part, as well as others who were trying to sort out aspects of post-traumatic stress, but also just war, that often get eclipsed by thinking about some aspects of PTSD or PTS, if you think about it primarily as a response to fear or a sense of being overwhelmed by the noise and the hypervigilance that comes with being attuned to war. Students and veterans that I was talking to were trying to figure out what happens when I do everything right, but I'm still struck by guilt. What happens when I leave buddies behind? What happens when the rules of engagement are such that I do everything right, but it still feels like the collateral killing is wrong? Or the reverse, that being unable to protect my troops seems cowardly in a certain way, but it's legally required. So I wanted to really think about the moral dimensions of psychological anguish that get overlooked a bit in many discussions of war ethics and of psychological trauma of war.
Well, I think that's what I found somewhat fascinating about this whole topic, was that your definition of moral wounds is pretty broad, and it even those men and women who come back and maybe don't have a medical or clinical diagnosis, can they still suffer from moral wounds?
Yeah. I'm not a clinician, and I'm not in the mode of putting forth a diagnostic code that has to get funding or be referenced somehow in medical documentation. And so I'm freed from some of the convention here. And that means that I'm thinking about moral injury on a wide spectrum, from very mild to severe, and maybe you would think of it in pathologizing terms of disorder. But I'm really as interested in people trying to figure out in long, struggling, ongoing ways of how to make sense of their war and how to make sense of the emotions, morally tinged emotions they're carrying that are symptomatic of that struggle. So I'm talking at the same time. You know, I'm not just talking clinically, you might say, or pathology-wise, you might say.
And I think that's, again, what's a very interesting aspect of this is certainly for those maybe spouses or friends and family members of returning military men and women who are thinking about this in terms of, boy, he doesn't have a diagnosis, but there's just something a little off, something a little deeper here that they may want to read after war, Healing the Moral Wounds of Our Soldiers by Nancy Sherman, publisher's Oxford. And you have an interesting comment in the book that there's no easy diagnosis for this, is there?
Well, that's right. I think, we're always subject to trends in medicine as well as in popular culture. And early on, maybe World War I, we talked about we had neurasthenia, war nerves, and often there were discussions about pre-existing conditions and personality disorders and the like. And then in 1980s or so, in post-Vietnam, we really came up with the diagnosis of PTSD as a part of the Diagnostic and Statistics Manual, the DSM. And it was very validating that people had responses, psychological responses, to real external threats, threats of dying and feeling helpless in the face of death and killing, and the response was a kind of traumatic fear. But we now realize that there are many, many, many other psychological responses that are every bit as need to be validated, need to be recognized, and some of them we should consider a part of post-traumatic stress, even though they're not fear-conditioned responses, and they might not respond well to fear-conditioned methods of therapy. But they may respond pretty well to empathic engagement by others, like what does it feel like to not believe you deserve to survive, but others do. That's an old phenomenon, survivor guilt, but it doesn't mean that many don't suffer from it. Or what does it mean to really wrestle with the fact that you thought the war was just and a just resort to force, but you don't think it now, and what does that mean for how you think of your own actions and the violence that ensued? What does it mean to really worry that you can't bring in an airstrike, but you used to be able to, and also you're not really winning hearts and minds at the same time you're not bringing in that airstrike, and so you're caught in the double bind that you're not really helping the civilians much, nor are you protecting your forces? Those are real moral dilemmas, and they have psychological consequence, and it's often hard to find the language and the terms and the words to process that if you're not thinking in broader terms than just I'm kind of hyper aroused, or I'm reliving bad memories, or I want to retreat, which are some of the ways we do think about PTSD traditionally.
So we're talking to Professor Nancy Sherman. She's just written a book called After War. That's one word, Healing the Moral Wounds of Our Soldiers. And, Nancy, one of the statements you have I'd like you to expand on that's in the book is that moral wounds demand moral healings.
Well,
pretty interesting comment. Tell us what you're thinking.
Yeah. So moral wounds really just mean ways that we hurt that have to do with the moral import and moral consequences of our actions, where we might experience a conflict of our who we think we should be and could be as a fighter or as someone engaged in war and who in fact we ended up being, and so falling short of expectations or having others fall short of their expectations or feeling you transgressed maybe in your ordinary self, but maybe not in your military self, but then you can't put those two together. So all of those create a lot of harsh tensions that, you know, and anguish. And healing often, when there's shame, well, before we heal, we often feel shame or guilt, and we often retreat. And that doesn't often help to repair the wounds. It isolates. It breaks bonds that could help to make us whole again in our families and in our schools or in our workplace. And so by healing, I mean, in part, being able to reintegrate with others and to re-cement bonds that are so important for nourishing our whole selves and for being able to sort of come back home to civilian life, which may, of course, include life with your units back home and your battle buddies, but also those that haven't really seen or looked close at what you've done, and you may be afraid of showing them. So I think healing is a kind of reentry process, and it involves other kinds of emotions that are maybe the flip side of the traumatizing ones. So in place of guilt, maybe some forgiveness or empathy. In place of distrust, a sense of trusting. In place of horrible sense of disappointment and despair, a sense of hope in yourself that you have worthwhileness and or worthiness, and that others see it and can help nurture it in you. You know, those are parts of healthy relationships, the best of times, but they're harder. Those are resources harder to renew, I think, after war.
Well, one of the other topics that you talk about in the book, and we're talking to Professor Nancy Sherman from Georgetown University, who recently wrote After War, is this idea between the military and civilian gap. And before we go to some other items here about sort of maybe how you get to the moral healing, I wanted you to talk a little bit about your view of the impact of that military-civilian gap, because you're approaching it from a philosophy, psychology, ethics viewpoint, and it's a little different than others that we've talked to on Veterans Radio.
Sure. Well, I'm the daughter of a veteran. My dad was a World War II Army medic. And so in many ways, I grew up with that gap. I really wasn't a member of his military family, and despite the fact that we had scratchy army blankets around, my dad never talked about his war except at the age of 89 and 65 years after he put on his dog tags. His dog tags were still in his pocket, and I found them when he died. And despite the fact that I was a very close daughter, I didn't know he had those dog tags in his pocket on his keychain. So we had our own kind of don't ask, don't tell policy. And that was a gap in my family, a MilSIV gap in a very clear way. Now, we talk about our wars more openly than World War II veterans do or did. And I know for a fact that returning veterans talk to their children and their spouses more readily than my dad did to me. But that was not healthy for me to be so cut off from his world, nor for him to bear the moral burdens alone. So that's part of evidence of an old version of it, and we still have signs of it today, even if less exacerbated. You know, we're in a non-conscription era now, unlike World War II or Vietnam, and so the numbers serving are much smaller, and the exposure of those who are serving to the larger population is much smaller and tends to be clustered in specific states and specific areas, and less visibility of service members in other places. And that's that plays out hard, I think. Another aspect of the MilSIV divide is we have veterans returning through the GI Bill to universities, but some don't want to necessarily talk. They're still kind of quartered, you might say, and they have underlying resentments that they get thank you for your service, but no real deeper interest in what they went through or no real sense of how to begin the conversation so it could go in a deeper way. So I mean all those things. I mean, it's important that we start removing some of the polite manners that go around, that circumscribe thank you for your service, so that in situations where we do have open discussion, a classroom, a workplace, a synagogue, a church, a mosque, you can really start getting to know what the life of a service member is like. And we don't have to think it's just over a beer with a fellow battle buddy that you can have that conversation.
Now, you have an interesting portion of the book afterward talking about how sort of what has become almost a rote statement of thank you for your service may be doing not necessarily more harm than good, but it may be cutting off a real opportunity for discussion in healing.
I think that's right. It puts up polite boundaries around a reentry ritual, and it's a very polite exchange of gratitude that masks sometimes resentment on the part of the service member. Someone that I was in a group discussion with once said, "Don't say thank you for your service, first say please." And I think it was cryptic, but I think this service member meant, let's have a conversation about the war you sent me to. And that's one way to broaden and deepen the conversation. Another way to broaden and deepen it is to sort of reflect openly about what is the contract we have with the service members whom we send through whatever forces and means we do send them, whether it's Congressional War Powers Act or not. What does it mean to have a non-conscription force, and what do we owe those individuals? Do we owe them badges of honor and paid patriotism, as we've learned to call it, through some of the games and the like, where service members that are disabled stand up? Or do we owe them more normalization in our classrooms and in our neighborhoods so that we can just get on and learn about their experiences?
Well, you make it clear in the book that it's really not a how-to fix-it book. And quite frankly, it's a little deep at times, that's right. I was going to get there. But it is filled with stories of real veterans with real issues and struggles and overcoming them that kind of keep it all flowing and tie it together. But before we kind of run out of time on this segment, I wanted you to talk about sort of three nuggets I've pulled out of this, I think, and that is how listening, hope, and trust help with the moral healing. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Sure. Well, one of the most moving service members I met was Lalo Paniagua. And he's a friend, and I met him through his spouse, Donna Hernandez, who was in my class. So an unusual case in that she was a senior in Georgetown School of Foreign Service and had been married since her freshman year to a service member to a Marine who served in Fallujah and in Marja. So he had tough tours of duty. And they married very young, both in a sense to escape an L.A. barrio. She came to Georgetown as her way out, and he joined the Marines, and they married. He came home injured, numerous physical injuries, but pretty severe post-traumatic stress, and ended up at Walter Reed at the Marine Warrior Resilience Brigade or something like that that it's called in. For a number of months with a care dog. Her interventions, I think, were probably the most saving of all, and that was she had hope in him from the beginning of his return home. And by that I mean, it wasn't just that she hoped for good outcomes and hoped that he'd do well and get a good job afterwards and heal from his injuries. She had hope in his goodness in a certain way. She had hope in his, that he could achieve certain normative, by that I mean he could achieve certain ideals and ends that she thought he was worthy of and that he doubted his own abilities to achieve. And she never kind of gave up on that trust in him and trust in his abilities. And with a, she's socially gifted. Many of us don't have that kind of social gift. So she really was an angel, his angel, and they're extremely loving, and he appreciated it. But times were hard and times were dark, and she has a kind of pesky street smarts as well as enduring patience and ability to get the job done. You need the DOJ, you need to call the Department of Justice because they say, you know, he had to pay for his flak vest when it came back bloodied. I'm not paying for that, you know, they have something else to tell me. And she had a lot of guts, you might say, and but she also never quite gave up hope in him and also helped him with figuring out how to get the machine working on his behalf. And that's in part what I mean by the kind of repair that comes by hoping in someone and also being able to show them that you still can count on them and that you're hoping reciprocally that they count on you for support. And I think that's so, so important. They were part of a larger system, no doubt, and that included medical care and included psychological care all the way and fighting a difficult system. He came home to Quantico. It was hard. People thought he was malingering. His boss thought he was malingering. It required intervention of superiors to set the record straight. He wasn't malingering. He needed these medical appointments. Someone had to intervene in order to get him placement at Walter Reed. But she was an advocate all the way, and it's hard to keep on loving under those circumstances, and she did. And they went.
Well, I do think one of the nuggets out of the book is just that in order to help people survive, overcome those moral wounds, others have to invest hope in that injured veteran. And trust in them. And then, as I said, the other point was you tell us about the importance of listening, emphatically listening to these soldiers who may have moral wounds so that we can help them on their way to a moral healing. I want to encourage all of our Veterans Radio listeners to go out and read and purchase Nancy Sherman's book, After War, Healing the Moral Wounds of Our Soldiers. I think you'll find it very instructive, particularly if you're in that situation with friends or family members where you need to understand a little bit more of what's going on and maybe how you can help. Professor Sherman, I want to thank you for participating in this interview today to give us a little insight. I want to encourage folks to look for a follow-up interview we're going to do with Professor Sherman on some moral war issues. But Nancy, where can folks find more about you and find more about After War?
Sure. Well, thank you. NancySherman.com, www.NancySherman.com. I have a webpage with some of my recent activities and panels with service members, including C.J. Chivers of the New York Times, a Marine and immersed correspondent. So that's a place, and the book is available on all formats, Audible as well as it's not paper yet, but hardback. And if you click on www.nancysherman.com, you can purchase right there through Amazon or one of the other independent booksellers.
And listeners, thank you for tuning in today to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or on the web at legalhelpforveterans.com. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to our podcasts and internet radio shows by going to www.veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.